Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this podcast episode, did you know that once upon a time, F. Scott Fitzgerald had a Christmas story published in his high school newspaper? He was 17 years old. Stay tuned for young Mr. Fitzgerald's story of a luckless Santa and more curious tales. It's a rogue's Christmas. This event took place at Town Hall Seattle on December 11th. Thank you to Jean Sherrard for curating the event and Sonia Harris for our recording. We're presenting our broadcast version here. You'll find additional stories on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. From everyone here at KUOW and Speakers Forum, best wishes for happy and healthy holidays. Here, Jean Sherrard introduces the first story.
We're going to start with A Christmas Cracker by Francis Scott Key Fitzgerald. And a few years before he changed the world of writing and literature with his masterpiece, The Great Gatsby, before Tender is the Night, before This Side of Paradise, and many, many short stories, he attended the prestigious Newman School in Hackensack, New Jersey. And this next story was written, believe it or not, by a 17-year-old F. Scott Fitzgerald. And it was published in his school newspaper. And I think that all the raw materials of what he later became are fully present here. In addition, the themes that he would kept returning to throughout his career, which was all too short, this story is an early prototype of those basic stories and the basic plots. A man pushed to do something or become someone for the love of a woman. So here's Con Doan again to read it for us.
A luckless Santa Claus. Miss Harmon was responsible for the whole thing. If it had not been for her foolish whim, Talbot would not have made a fool of himself. And, oh, but I am getting ahead of my story. It was Christmas Eve. Salvation Army Santa Clauses with highly colored noses proclaimed it as they beat upon rickety paper chimneys with tin spoons. Package-laden old bachelors forgot to worry about how many slippers and dressing gowns they would have to thank people for next day and join in the general air of excitement that pervaded busy Manhattan. In the parlor of a house situated on a dimly lighted residence street, somewhere east of Broadway, sat the lady who, as I said before, started the whole business. She was holding a conversation, half frivolous, half sentimental, with a faultlessly dressed young man who sat with her on the sofa. All of this was quite right and proper, however, for they were engaged to be married in June.
"Harry Talbot," said Dorothy Harmon, as she rose and stood laughing at the merry young gentleman beside her. "If you aren't the most ridiculous boy I ever met, I'll eat that terrible box of candy you brought me last week."
"Dorothy," reproved the young man, "you should receive gifts in the spirit in which they were given. That box of candy cost me much of my hard-earned money."
"Oh, your hard-earned money indeed," scoffed Dorothy. "You know very well that you never earned a cent in your life. Golf and dancing, that is the sum total of your occupations. Why, you can't even spend money, much less earn it."
"My dear Dorothy, I succeeded in running up some very choice bills last month, as you will find if you consult my father."
"That's not spending your money. That's wasting it. Why, I don't think you could give away $25 in the right way to save your life."
"But why on earth," remonstrated Harry, "should I want to give away $25?
"Because," explained Dorothy, "that would be real charity. It's nothing to charge a debt to your father and have it sent to me, but to give money to people you don't know is something. Why, any old fellow can give away money, protested Harry. Then, exclaimed Dorothy, we'll see if you can. I don't believe that you could give $25 in the course of an evening if you tried. Indeed, I could. Then try it. And Dorothy, dashing into the hall, took down his coat and hat and placed them in his reluctant hands. It is now 8:30. You be here by 10 o'clock. But, Dorothy was edging him towards the door. How much money have you? She demanded. Harry gloomily put his hand in his pocket and counted out a handful of bills. Exactly $25. Oh, and 5 cents. Very well. Now listen, these are the conditions. You go out and give the money to anybody you care to, whom you have never seen before. Don't give more than $2 to any one person and be back here by 10 o'clock with no more than 5 cents in your pocket. But, declared Harry, still backing towards the door, I want my $25. Harry, said Dorothy sweetly, I am surprised. And with that, she slammed the door in his face. I insist, muttered Harry. This is a most unusual proceeding. He walked down the steps and hesitated. Now, he thought, where shall I go? He considered a moment and finally started off towards Broadway. He had gone about 1/2 block when he saw a gentleman in a top hat approaching. Harry hesitated. Then he made up his mind and, stepping towards the man, emitted what he intended for a pleasant laugh, but what sounded more like a gurgle, and loudly vociferated, Merry Christmas, friend! The same to you, answered he of the top hat. And he would have passed on, but Harry was not to be denied. My good fellow, he cleared his throat, would you like me to give you a little money? What? Yelled the man. You might need some money, don't you know, to buy the children a rag doll, he finished brilliantly. The next moment his hat went sailing into the gutter, and when he picked it up, the man was far away. Well, there's 5 minutes wasted, muttered Harry, as full of wrath towards Dorothy, he strode away. He strode along his way. He decided to try a different method with the next people he met. He would express himself more politely. Oh, a couple approached him. A young lady and her escort. Harry halted directly in their path, took off his hat, and addressed them. As it is Christmas, you know, and everybody gives away articles, why... Give him a dollar, Billy, and let's go on, said the young lady. Billy obediently thrust a dollar into Harry's hand, and at that moment, the girl gave a cry of surprise. Why, it's Harry Talbot, she exclaimed, begging! But Harry heard no more. When he realized he knew the girl, he turned and sped like an arrow up the street, cursing his foolhardiness and taking up the affair at all. He approached Broadway and started slowly down the gaily lighted thoroughfare, intending to give money to the street urchins he met. All around him, the bustle was the bustle of preparation. Everywhere swarmed people, happy in the pleasant concert of their own generosity. Harry felt strangely out of place as he wandered aimlessly along. He was used to being catered to and bowed before. But here no one spoke to him, and one or two even had the audacity to smile at him and wish him a Merry Christmas. He nervously accosted a passing boy. I say, little boy, I'm going to give you some money.
No, you ain't, said the boy sturdily. I don't want none of your money.
Rather abashed, Harry continued down the street. He tried to present 50 cents to an inebriated man, but a policeman tapped him on the shoulder and told him to move on. He drew up beside a ragged individual and quietly whispered, "Do you wish some money?"
I'm on, said the tramp. What's the job?
Oh, there's no job, Harry reassured him.
Trying to kid me, eh? Growled the tramp resentfully. Well, get somebody else.
And he slunk off into the crowd. Next, Harry tried to squeeze 10 cents into the hand of a passing bellboy, but the youth pulled open his coat and displayed a sign, no tipping.
Ah, with the air of a thief, Harry approached an Italian bootblack and cautiously deposited 10 cents in his hand. At a safe distance, he saw the boy wonderingly pocket the dime and congratulated himself. He had but $24.90 yet to give away. His last success gave him a plan. He stopped at a newsstand where, in full sight of the vendor, he dropped a $2 bill and sped away in the crowd. After several minutes hard running, he came to a walk amidst the curious glances of bundle-laden passersby and was mentally patting himself on the back when he heard quick breathing behind him and the very newsie he had just left thrust into his hand the $2 bill and was off like a flash. The perspiration streamed from Harry's forehead, and he trudged along despondently. He got rid of 25 cents, however, by dropping it into a children's aid slot. He tried to get 50 cents in, but it was a small slot. His first large sum was $2 to a Salvation Army Santa Claus, and after this, he kept a sharp lookout for them. But it was past their closing time, and he saw no more of them on his journey. He was now crossing Union Square, and after another half hour's patient work, he found himself with only $15 to give away. A wet snow was falling, which turned to slush as it touched the pavements, and the light dancing pumps he wore were drenched, the water oozing out of his shoe with every step he took. He reached Cooper Square and turned into the Bowery. The number of people on the streets was fast thinning, and all around him the shops were closing up and their occupants going home. Some boys jeered at him, but turning up his collar, he plodded on. In his ears rang the saying, mockingly yet kindly, "It is more blessed to give than to receive." He turned up Third Avenue and counted his remaining money. It amounted to $3.70. Ahead of him, he perceived through the thickening snow two men standing under a lamppost. Here was his chance. He could divide his $3.70 between them. He came up to them and tapped one on the shoulder. The man, a thin, ugly-looking fellow, turned suspiciously. "Won't you have some money, you fellow?" he said imperiously, for he was angry at humanity in general, and Dorothy in particular. The fellow turned savagely. "Ah," he sneered, "you're one of these stiffs trying a charity gag and then getting us pulled for begging. Come on, Jim, let's show 'em what we are." And they showed him. They hit him. They mashed him. They got him down and jumped on him. They broke his hat. They tore his coat. And Harry, gasping, striking, panting, went down in the slush. He thought of the people who had that very night wished him a Merry Christmas. He was certainly having it. Miss Dorothy Harmon closed her book with a snap. It was past 11, and no Harry. What was keeping him? He'd probably given up and gone home long ago. With this in mind, she reached up to turn out the light, when suddenly she heard a noise outside as if someone had fallen. Dorothy rushed to the window and pulled up the blind. There, coming up the steps, on his hands and knees was a wretched caricature of a man. He was hatless, coatless, collarless, tieless, and covered with snow. It was Harry!
He opened the door and walked into the parlor, leaving a trail of wet snow behind him. "Well," he said defiantly.
"Harry," she gasped. "Can it be you?"
"Dorothy," he said solemnly, "it is me."
What has happened?"
"Oh, nothing. I've just been giving away that $25. And Harry sat down on the sofa.
"But Harry," she faltered, "your eye is all swollen."
"Oh, my eye? Let me see. Oh, that was on the 22nd dollar. I had some difficulty with two gentlemen. However, we afterwards struck up quite an acquaintance. I had some luck after that. I dropped $2 in a blind beggar's hat."
"You've been all evening giving away that money."
"My dear Dorothy, I have decidedly been all evening giving away that money." He rose and brushed a lump of snow from his shoulder. "I really must be going now. I have two friends outside waiting for me." He walked towards the door.
"Two friends?"
Why, they are the two gentlemen I had difficulty with. They are coming home with me to spend Christmas. They are really nice fellows, though they might seem a trifle rough at first." Dorothy drew a quick breath. For a minute, no one spoke. Then he took her in his arms.
"Dearest," she whispered, "you did all this for me."
A minute later, he sprang down the steps, and arm in arm with his friends, walked off in the darkness. "Good night, Dorothy," he called back, and Merry Christmas.
Muriel Spark, whose name should ever live and always be praised, was an impoverished, little-known poet and writer who, born in Scotland also, along with Allie Smith, until she beat out 7,000 entries for the following short story, which was published in the London Observer, and won a prize of £250, which convinced her that she could make a living as a fiction writer. Because she hadn't earned anything on the same story as a poem. So that turned Spark to fiction, and later you may recall The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie, which became a movie with Maggie Smith and a number of other rather extraordinary novels and short stories. So this is the turning point. This short story, which is quite deliriously wonderful, and reading it, we have, for the very first time, the director of the entire Short Stories Live series, and he has been for the last 10, 11, 12 years, Kurt Beatty. So let's have a hand for Kurt. Now, before I turn you over, I just want to say, Kurt's an actor, a writer, a playwright. Is now the artistic director emeritus of ACT Theater, and until this year, we could never get him for Christmas because he was always playing Scrooge at ACT. So it's such a pleasure to have you show up. But there's one secret I learned talking to Kurt the other day, which is that all of this stuff notwithstanding, all of these extraordinary, you know, legendary pursuits that Kurt has indulged in, to me, they pale before what I just discovered. He was a professional boy soprano at St. John's School of Divine in New York, their boys' choir. And that takes the cake. I think that's... So, I... So my question, which I've never asked, did you experience were there moments of terror as your voice was approaching, you know, the end when you could no longer sing the boy's part?
Actually, yes, because uh, as even I and my idiot self at that age knew that not to be able to sing William Byrd and Thomas Tallis and Thomas Wilkes was a loss. But then I began to found croaking my way through my voice changing that I could actually sing them as a bass. So that was okay.
It's wonderful.
And then, you know, there were the Stones and the Beatles too, which changed me.
Yeah.
The Seraph and the Zambezi by Muriel Spark. You may have heard of Samuel Cramer, half poet, half journalist, who had to do with a dancer called the Fanfarlo? No? But as you will see, it doesn't matter if you have not. He was said to be going strong in Paris early in the 19th century. And when I met him in 1946, he was still going strong, but this time in a different way. He was the same man, but modified. For instance, in those days, more than 100 years ago, Cramer had persisted for several decades and without affectation in being about 25 years old. But when I knew him, he was clearly undergoing his 42-year-old phase. At this time, he was keeping a petrol pump some 4 miles south of the Zambezi River, where it crashes over a precipice at the Victoria Falls. Cramer had some spare rooms where he put up visitors to the falls when the hotel was full. I was sent to him because it was Christmas week and there was no room at the hotel. I found him trying the starter of a large, lumpy Mercedes outside his corrugated iron garage, and at first sight I judged him to be a Belgian from the Congo. He had the look of North and South, light hair with canvas-colored skin. Later, however, he told me that his father was a German and his mother Chilean. It was this information, rather than the S. Dot Cramer above the garage door, which made me think I had heard of him. The rains had been very poor, and that December was fiercely hot. On the third night before Christmas, I sat on the step outside my room, looking through the broken mosquito wire network at the lightning in the distance. When an atmosphere maintains an excessive temperature for a long spell, something seems to happen to the natural noises of life. Sound fails to carry in its usual quantity, but comes as if bound and gagged. That night, the Christmas beetles, which fall on their backs on every step with a high tick-tack, seemed to be shock-absorbed. I saw one fall, and the little bump reached my ears a fraction behind time. The noises of minor wild beasts from the bush were all hushed up, too. In fact, it wasn't until the bush noises all stopped simultaneously, as they frequently do when a leopard is about, that I knew there had been any sound at all. Overlying this general muted hum, Cramer's sundowner party progressed further up the step. The heat distorted every word. The glasses made a tinkle that was not of the substance of glass, but of bottles wrapped in tissue paper. Sometimes, for a moment, a shriek or a cackle would hang torpidly in space. But these were unreal sounds, as if projected from a distant country, as if they were pocket torches seen through a London fog. Cramer came over to my end of the step and asked me to join his party. I said I would be glad to, and meant it, even though I had been glad to sit alone. Heat, so persistent and so intense, sucks up the will. 5 people sat in wicker armchairs drinking highballs and chewing salted peanuts. I recognized a red-haired trooper from Livingston, just out from England, and 2 of Cramer's lodgers, a tobacco planter and his wife from Bulawayo. In the custom of those parts, the other 2 were introduced by their first names. Manny, a short, dark man with square face and build, I thought might be Portuguese from the East Coast. The woman, Fanny, was picking bits out of the frayed wicker chair, and as she lifted her glass, her hand shook a little, making her bracelets chime. She would be about 50, a well-tended woman, very neat. Her gray hair, tinted with blue, was done in a fringe above a face puckered with malaria. In the general way of passing the time with strangers in that countryside, I exchanged with the tobacco people the names of acquaintances who lived within a 600-mile radius of where we sat, reducing this list to names mutually known to us. The trooper contributed his news from the region between Lusaka and Livingston. Meanwhile, an argument was in process between Kramer, Fanny, and Manny, of which Fanny seemed to be getting the better. It appeared there was to be a play or concert on Christmas Eve, in which the three were taking part. I several times heard the words troop of angels, shepherds, ridiculous price, and my girls, which seemed to be key words in the argument. Suddenly, on hearing the trooper mention a name, Fanny broke off her talk and turned to us. She was one of my girls, she said. I gave her lessons for 3 years. Manny rose to leave, and before Fanny followed him, she picked a card from her handbag and held it out to me between her fingernails. If any of your friends are interested, said Fanny hazily. I looked at this as she drove off with the man, and above an address about 4 miles up the river, I read, Madame La Fanfarlo, Paris, London, dancing instructress, ballet, ballroom, transport provided by arrangement. Next day, I came across Kramer still trying to locate the trouble with the Mercedes. Are you the man Baudelaire wrote about? I asked him. He stared past me at the open waste veldt with a look of tired patience. Yes, he replied. What made you think of it? The name Fanfarlo on Fanny's card. I said, didn't you know her in Paris? Oh, yes, said Kramer, but those days are finished. She married Manuela de Monteverde. That's Manny. They settled here about 20 years ago. He keeps a kaffir store. I remembered then that in the Romantic Age it had pleased Kramer to fluctuate between the practice of verse and that of belles lettres, together with the living up to such practices. I asked him, have you given up your literary career? As a career, yes, he answered. It was an obsession I was glad to get rid of. He stroked the blue bonnet of the Mercedes and added, the greatest literature is the occasional kind, a mere afterthought. Again, he looked across the veldt where, unseen, a gray-crested lorry known by its cry as the go-away bird was piping, go away, go away. Life, Kramer continued, is the important thing. And do you write occasional verses? I inquired. When occasion demands it, he said. In fact, I've just written a nativity masque. We're giving a performance on Christmas Eve, in there. He pointed to his garage, where a few natives were already beginning to shift petrol cans and tires. Being members neither of the cast nor of the audience, they were taking their time. A pile of folded seats had been dumped alongside. Late on the morning of Christmas Eve, I returned from the falls to find a crowd of natives quarreling outside the garage, with Kramer swearing loud and heavily in the middle. He held a sulky man by the shirt sleeve, while with the other hand he described his vituperation on the hot air. Some mission natives had been sent over to give a hand with laying the stage, and these, with their standard three-school English, washed faces and white drill shorts, had innocently provoked Kramer's raw, rag-dressed boys. Kramer's method, which ended with the word police, succeeded in sending them back to work, still uttering drum-like gutturals at each other. The stage, made of packing cases with planks nailed across, was being put at the back of the building, where a door led to the yard, the privy, and the native huts. The space between this door and the stage was closed off by a row of black government blankets hung on a line. This was to be the dressing room. I agreed to come round there that evening to help with the lighting, the makeup, and the pinning on of angels' wings. The Fanfarlow's dancing pupils were to make an angel chorus with carols and dancing, while she herself, as the Virgin, was to give a representative ballet performance. Owing to her husband's very broken English, he had been given a silent role as a shepherd, supported by three other shepherds chosen for like reasons. Kramer's part was the most prominent, for he had the longest speeches, being the first seraph. It had been agreed that since he had written the mask, he could best deliver most of it, but I gathered there had been some trouble at rehearsals over the cost of the production, with Fanny wanting elaborate scenery as being due to her girls. The performance was set to begin at 8. I arrived behind the stage at 7:15 to find the angels assembled in ballet dresses with wings of crinkled paper in various shades. The Fanfarlow wore a long white transparent skirt with a sequined top. I was helping to fix on the wise men's beards when I saw Kramer. He had on a toga-like garment made up of several thicknesses of mosquito net, but not thick enough to hide his white shorts underneath. He had put on his makeup early, and this was melting on his face in the rising heat. "I always get nerves at this point," he said. "I'm going to practice my opening speech." I heard him mount the stage and begin reciting. Above the voices of excited children, I could only hear the rhythm of his voice, and I was intent on helping the Fanfarlow to paint her girls' faces. It seemed impossible. As fast as we lifted the sticks of paint, they turned liquid. It was getting really abnormally hot. "Open that door," yelled the Fanfarlow. The back door was opened, and a crowd of curious natives pressed round the entrance. I left the Fanfarlow, ordering them off, for I was determined to get to the front of the building for some air. I mounted the stage and began to cross it when I was aware of a powerful radiation of heat coming from my right. Looking round, I saw Kramer apparently shouting at someone in the attitude of his dealings with the natives that morning. But he could not advance because of this current of heat. And because of the heat, I could not at first make out who Kramer was rowing with. This was the sort of heat that goes for the eyes. But as I got further towards the front of the stage, I saw what was standing there. This was a living body. The most noticeable thing was its constancy. It seemed not to conform to the law of perspective, but remained the same size when I approached as when I withdrew. And altogether, unlike other forms of life, it had a completed look. No part was undergoing a process. The outline lacked the signs of confusion and ferment, which are commonly the signs of living things. And this was also the principle of its beauty. The eyes took up nearly the whole of the head, extending far over the cheekbones. From the back of the head came two muscular wings, which from time to time folded themselves over the eyes, making a draft of scorching air. There was hardly any neck. Another pair of wings, tough and supple, spread from below the shoulders, and a third pair extended from the calves of the legs, appearing to sustain the body. The feet looked too fragile to bear up such a concentrated degree of being. European residents of Africa are often irresistibly prompted to speak kitchen Kaffir to anything strange. "Hamba!" shouted Kramer, meaning, "Go away!" "Now get off the stage and stop your noise," said the living body peaceably.
"Who in the hell are you?" said Kramer, gasping through the heat.
"The same as in heaven," came the reply. "A seraph's, that's to say."
"Tell that to someone else," Kramer panted. "Do I look like a fool?"
"I will. No, nor a seraph either," said the seraph. The place was filling with heat from the seraph. Kramer's paint was running into his eyes, and he wiped them on his net robe. Walking backward to a less hot place, he cried, "Once and for all!" "That's correct," said the Seraph. "This is my show," continued Kramer. "Since when?" the Seraph said. "Right from the start," Kramer breathed at him. "Well, it's been mine from the beginning," said the Seraph. "And the beginning came first." Climbing down from the hot stage, Kramer caught his seraphic robe on a nail and tore it. "Listen here," he said. "I can't conceive of an abnormality like you being a true seraph." "True," said the seraph. By this time, I had been driven by the heat to the front entrance. Kramer joined me there. A number of natives had assembled. The audience had begun to arrive in cars, and the rest of the cast had come around the building from the back. It was impossible to see far inside the building owing to the seraph's heat and impossible to re-enter. Kramer was still haranguing the seraph from the door, and there was much speculation amongst the new arrivals as to which of the three familiar categories the present trouble came under, namely the natives, Whitehall, or leopards. "This is my property," cried Kramer, "and these people have paid for their seats. They've come to see a mask." "In that case," said the seraph, "I'll cool down, and they can come and see a mask."
"My mask," said Kramer.
"Ah, no, mine," said the seraph.
"Yours won't do."
"Will you go, or shall I call the police?" said Kramer with finality. "I have no alternative," said the seraph. More finally still. Word had gone round that a mad leopard was in the garage. People got back into their cars and parked at a safe distance. The tobacco planter went to fetch a gun. A number of young troopers had the idea of blinding the mad leopard with petrol and ganged up some natives to fill petrol cans from the pump and pass them chainwise to the garage. "This'll fix him," said the trooper. "That's right, let him have it," said Kramer from his place by the door.
"I shouldn't do that," said the seraph. "You'll cause a fire."
The first lot of petrol began to be flung into the heat, and it flared up. The seats caught light first, and then the air itself began to burn within the metal walls till the whole interior was flame feeding on flame. Another carload of troopers arrived just then and promptly got a gang of natives to fill petrol cans with water. Slowly, they drenched the fire. The Funfarlow mustered her angels a little way up the road. She was trying to reassure their parents and see what was happening at the same time, furious at losing her opportunity to dance. She aimed a hard poke at the back of one of the angels whose parents were in England. It was some hours before the fire was put out. While the corrugated metal walls still glowed, twisted, and furled, it was impossible to see what had happened to the seraph. And after they had ceased to glow, it was too dark and hot to see far into the wreck.
"Are you insured?" one of Kramer's friends asked him.
"Oh, yes," Kramer replied. "My policy covers everything except acts of God. That means lightning and flood."
"He's fully covered," said Kramer's friend to another friend. Many people had gone home, and the rest were going. The troopers drove off singing "Good King Wenceslas," and the mission boys ran down the road singing "Good Christian Men Rejoice." It was about midnight and still very hot. The tobacco planters suggested a drive to the falls where it was cool. Kramer and the Funfarlow joined us, and we bumped along the rough path from Kramer's to the main highway. There, the road is tarred only in two strips to take car wheels. The thunder of the falls reached us about 2 miles before we reached them.
"After all my work on the mask and everything," Kramer was saying.
"Oh, shut up," said the Funfarlow. Just then, by the glare of our headlights, I saw the seraph again, going at about 70 miles an hour and skimming the tarmac strips with two of his 6 wings in swift motion, 2 folded over his face and 2 covering his feet.
"That's him," said Kramer. "We'll get him yet."
We left the car near the hotel and followed a track through the dense vegetation of the rainforest, where the spray from the falls descends perpetually. It was like a convalescence after fever. that frail rain after the heat. The seraph was far ahead of us, and through the trees I could see where his heat was making steam of the spray. We came to the cliff's edge, where opposite us and from the same level, the full weight of the river came blasting into the gorge between. There was no sign of the seraph. Was he far below in the heaving pit, or where? Then I noticed that along the whole mile of the waterfall's crest, the spray was rising higher than usual. This I took to be steam from the seraph's heat. I was right, for presently, by the mute flashes of summer lightning, we watched him ride the Zambezi away from us among the rocks that looked like crocodiles and the crocodiles that looked like rocks. Thank you.
James Thurber was one of the most popular humorists of his time, of all time. He was a cartoonist, New Yorker writer, journalist, playwright, author. And our first reading this afternoon is a version of The Night Before Christmas in the style of Ernest Hemingway. And here's Paul wearing his hat and covered with his blanket, and he's going to get us started this afternoon. Paul Dorpat. You can start now, Paul.
Where's my script?
Your script, script is in your hat, Paul. Your script is in your hat.
Oh. You're right. Thank you. Okay. That's kind of threatening. Either. All right, here we go. Now, you're going to participate in this to some extent in the middle. So stay alert, because your time's coming. This is called A Visit from St. Nicholas in the Ernest Hemingway Manner by James Thurber. It was the night before Christmas. The house was very quiet. No creatures were stirring in the house. There weren't even any mice stirring. The stockings had been hung carefully by the chimney. The children hoped that St. Nicholas would come and fill them. The children were in their beds. Their beds were in the room next to ours. Mama and I were in our beds. Mama wore a kerchief. I had my cap on. I could hear the children moving. We didn't move. We wanted the children to think we were asleep. Father, the children said. There was no answer. He's there all right, they thought. Father, they said, and banged on their beds. What do you want? I asked.
We have visions of sugar plums,
the children said.
Go to sleep,
said Mama.
We can't sleep,
said the children. They stopped talking, but I could hear them moving. They made sounds. That's the highlight. That
Can you sleep?
Asked the children. No, I said.
You ought to sleep.
I know I ought to sleep.
Can we have some sugar plums?
You can't have any sugar plums, said Mama.
We just asked you.
There was a long silence. I could hear the children moving again.
Is St. Nicholas asleep?
Asked the children.
No, Mama said. Be quiet.
What the hell would he be asleep tonight for? I asked.
He might be, the children said. He isn't, I said. Let's try to sleep, said Baba. The house became quiet once more. I could hear the rustling noises the children made when they moved in their beds. Out on the lawn, a clatter arose. I got out of bed and went to the window. I opened the shutters, then I threw up the sash. The moon shone on the snow. The moon gave the luster of midday to objects in the snow. There was a miniature sleigh in the snow and 8 tiny reindeer. A man was driving them. He was lively and quick. He whistled and shouted at the reindeer and called them by their names. Their names, and here's where you come in, okay? You know their names. Let's say it all together. I'll give you the first two, and then you say them, okay, in order. Their first two are, what are they? Dasher and Dancer. You remember that? Okay, their names were Dasher. Very good. Let's give ourselves a hand, a big hand. Gene, that was all right that I did that, wasn't it? Gene, is Gene around?
Yeah, I'm right here. I'm
is that okay?
Yeah, that's great.
All right, thank you. Okay, he told them to dash away to the top of the porch, and then he told them to dash away to the top of the wall. They did. The sleigh was full of toys. Who is it? Mama asked. Some guy, I said, a little guy. I pulled my head in out of the window and listened. I heard the reindeer on the roof. I could hear their hoofs pawing and prancing on the roof. Shut the window, said Mama. I stood still and listened.
What do you hear?
Reindeer, I said. I shut the window and walked about. It was cold. Mama sat up in the bed and looked at me.
How would they get on the roof?
Mama asked.
They fly.
Get into bed. You'll catch cold. No, that's not.
Get into bed. You'll catch. Get into bed. You'll catch cold.
Mama lay down in bed. I didn't get into bed. I kept walking around.
What do you mean they fly?
Asked Mama. Just fly, that's all. Mama turned away toward the wall. She didn't say anything. I went out into the room where the chimney was. The little man came down the chimney and stepped into the room. He was dressed all in fur. His clothes were covered with ashes and soot from the chimney, and on his back was a pack, like a peddler's pack. There were toys in it. His cheeks and nose were red, and he had dimples. His eyes twinkled. His mouth was little, like a bow, and his beard was very white. Between his teeth was a stumpy pipe. The smoke from the pipe encircled his head in a wreath. He laughed, and his belly shook. It shook like a bowl of red jelly. I laughed. He winked his eye, then gave a twist to his head. He didn't say anything. He turned to the chimney and filled the stockings and turned away from the chimney. Laying his finger aside his nose, he gave a nod. Then he went up the chimney, and I went to the chimney and looked up. I saw him get into the sleigh. He whistled at his team, and the team flew away. The team flew as lightly as thistledown. The driver called out, "Merry Christmas and good night." I went back to bed.
What was it?
Asked Mama.
St. Nicholas,
she smiled,
Yeah. I said, St. Nicholas, you're right. She sighed and turned in the bed. I saw him, I said. Sure, I did see him. Sure you saw him. Sure you saw him. You see, I forgot her voice again. We're coming to the end, you know. I won't make mistakes like that. I saw him, I said. Sure, I did see him. Sure you saw him. She turned further to the wall. Father, said the children, there you go, Mama said. You and your flying reindeer. Go to sleep, I said.
Can we see St. Nicholas when he comes?
The children asked. You've got to be asleep, I said. You've got to be asleep when he comes. You can't see him unless you're unconscious.
Father knows, Mama said.
I pulled the covers over my mouth. It was warm under the covers. As I went to sleep, I wondered if Mama was right. That's it.
That's it for this podcast of Speakers Forum featuring A Rogue's Christmas. Again, you can hear the complete version on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. And thanks again to Sonia Harris for our recording. Tune in again soon.